From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome everybody to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? As we enter yet another new, are we going to call it a year or a decade, gentlemen? We'll discuss that perhaps later on.
But yeah.
Joining me as always from, I presume, the lake is Roger Mitchell. Roger, there?
Yes, I'm on the lake, ready to go, welcoming back the captain as well.
Yes, the captain is with us. Giles Morgan, come in, sir.
Yeah, well, I've just been sort of priming my rigging for the first edition of the Captain's Table, which we start next week, as you know. But I'm in Wandsworth currently, just sort of beached my good ship to speak to everybody.
I really want no part of you priming your rigging. If it's all the same for us, I think you should keep that.
There's a song in there somewhere, isn't there?
For the explicit podcast. Well, gents, the weeks just seem to fly by. I can't believe the new year has come and gone. Everyone's now focused on 2020 and new decades and all stuff. It just seems to have gone in a blur, and there's so much been going on. What a fantastic weekend this was for football, Rog.
It was. Mourinho, I think, is feeling the cold winds of reality, whereas Klopp...
As you said he would.
Yeah, whereas Klopp is continuing, defying all data algorithms known to man. I follow a few of these ex-goal type, stats bomb type situations, and Liverpool just keep defying the odds, which is costing me a little bit of money, but so be it.
But you know what? They're doing it in a way that, for the neutral, is just such a delight.
Damn the neutral! I'm losing money.
I don't care about. I don't care about you and your money. I thought Firmino's goal, the way he just let that ball run across him, was just so classy. It was just so good to watch.
Yeah, it was. It was. No, it was good. Listen, great weekend. I think there's going to be a lot of surprises, both in England and Scotland and Italy, of course, where we had some great games. Sad to see Zaniolo get the cruciate there. Conte doing well and Juventus starting to warm up a little bit. And of course, that wonderful little scene you saw with Simeone, where he saw his player get chopped down. And while the guy was sent off, I don't know whether he saw it, he gave him a knowing wink to say, that's what we do when we're professional footballers. I love that. That was my highlight of the week, now that I think of it.
And what about the captain? Anything catch your eye at the weekend, Giles?
Well, it did, but it's not been sport. It's been this pantomime of Prince Harry and everything that's going on. And I couldn't actually get to the back pages, because I think on the Daily Mail, there were sort of 27 pages on royal watching. So I'm so chuffed to be on this show so we can get back to sport. I really am. I'm excited because you saw a lot of tennis going down in Australia. So that's the start of the new season as we build up to the Aussie Open. There's the HSBC Abu Dhabi Golf Championship starts this week. And it just feels it's the end of, we've had the end of the holidays. And all of the sports are now cranking up, and we've just got 2020 to look forward to. It's really exciting.
Well, look, once again, guys, we have a fabulous guest joining us. Roger, why don't you introduce our guest to the listeners?
James Elliott from Room 9. Very, very interesting in the sports industry in the UK. Started out at the FA with our old friend Jonty Hill, and then went into the agency world with Kentaro. And then very, very interesting after that, was hired by the infamous and underrated Gary Cook at UFC, and was part of creating what became a $4 billion property subsequently bought by the wonderful Ari Emanuel, for those of us who follow Entourage, Ari Gold. After that, he set up his own business, the aforementioned Room 9, where he's dealing with what I would call the new models of sport, you know, how to take more niche sports and make them sustainable in a world where perhaps the pay TV dollar isn't going to be as prevalent. So really looking forward to James segueing a little bit from the last podcast with Joe Markovsky and new models at DAZN to tell us a little bit about how he sees the sport in the next decade.
Well, let's bring James in, shall we?
Hello.
Hello, James. Roger here.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Not bad. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Good. Let me introduce you quickly to my co-hosts, Giles and Grant Williams.
Hello there, mate. It's Giles here.
Hi, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Giles. How are you doing? You all right? Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on. Nice to meet you, albeit over the internet.
It's way better to meet us over the internet than in person, I promise you.
Yeah, same here, in fairness.
James, we're going to try in this year of the podcast to get into the meat of our conversations a little bit quicker. That's been some of the feedback that we've been getting, that we want to get to the core of the questions. And you and I know each other well. So I'm going to start with something following on very quickly that I would like you to get your teeth into straight away. And as you know, the style here is very informal, very, very informal. So here's my question to you, mate. How fucked is sport in 2020?
Well, in fairness, you've answered one of my initial questions, which was, can I swear on this podcast? So that's straight out the gate. We've answered that one. No, it's, I think some of it very much so, some of it not at all, is the honest answer to the question. One thing I can say with fairly sure certainty is that probably 70% of the sports business isn't prepared for it, which, to be honest, is the most concerning thing.
So you believe, as I think, you know, most people would say I do, that we're at this famous 10 minutes to midnight for 70% of sport. They haven't realized that the model's changed. They haven't realized that pay TV is going to spend more of its dollar in the premium sports. You, with your business, have positioned yourself as helping what I would call second, third, and emerging sports properties to find a sustainable model. Tell us a little bit about specifically those kind of sports like surfing, like MMA, and all of that around there. Tell us a little bit about how you see they'll find a future.
Yeah, look, I completely agree. I think tier one sports and premium sports are gonna level off and flatline, but mostly hold their value, maybe some small incremental increases in certain places. And I think the opportunity for smaller niche and kind of challenger sports to really develop their own communities and to bring that value of that smaller community with them to whichever platform they go to is the real opportunity. I think the people in response to your first question in terms of which parts are going to struggle, I think the ones which are going to struggle the most are those kind of second tier properties who are encumbered by rights contracts and organizational structures that don't allow them to react and respond to the evolving market. The good thing that that some of the smaller rights holders have as they start out on this business and trying to find a foothold in the new landscape is that they don't have any of these problems, you know, which is one of the challenges for them is obviously historical lack of revenues which are flowing from the more traditional media space. But I think that's actually an opportunity for them to build a rights proposition and to build a segmentation which allows them to go and take these communities to service smaller kind of sectors of the market, which is what the big broadcasters are going to need once they've reached scale with some of the bigger properties. You know, the growth is going to come from adding a lower price point, smaller properties that bring a definable, addressable audience with them. So that's kind of what I've been doing with Room 9 since I started it, was to help these smaller businesses to understand where their audience is and to understand their role and their position in the marketplace now. And to say, look, there's still a market out there for these sports, but you're going to have to work a lot harder. You know, the rights business that we've all been fortunate to be a part of for the last, you know, 25 years has just been an unending upward curve of rights valuations. And I think those days are over, and it's going to be a, You have to be a very smart organization now to be able to maximize your value. And you have to understand that your value is going to be driven by yourselves and not by somebody writing you a big check. I think there still definitely is money out there for people, but you're going to have to work much, much harder to get it.
So let's give people at this point, after you've come in with something which, as you know, I probably agree with that 100%, give people a little bit of an idea of why you're entitled to have that kind of opinion because of where you've worked before. Take us through the very quickly the stops at the FA and the agency world and obviously UFC. Tell us a little bit about how you've got to where you are today, James.
It's been a long and winding road. I actually filled out a presentation the other day where I said, with 20 years experience in the rights industry, which is a terrifying thing. I always thought I was the youngest person in the room. Sadly, no longer the case. My journey in sport really began at the IMG. And there's no better, it has many flaws, IMG, but there's no better school for learning the rights business. And I kind of took the decision when I joined that business to be a generalist. And understand all the aspects of the commercial world of sport, and then to develop a specialism in obviously the main revenue driver, which is media. So that's kind of been my position, and I've tried to take roles around the business which have enabled me to deepen those kind of verticals of experience, as it were. So from IMG, I had a brief period at Puma where I ran their football marketing in the UK, and then got moved over via one of my old bosses, Jonathan Hill, to join the FA as they built out their own internal media rights team. So that was really, so 2005, 2006 was when kind of these businesses started to build out their own internal businesses to be able to deliver against the rights market, which traditionally had just been outsourced to agencies. So bringing that expertise in-house, which then enabled the FA to quadruple their international broadcast revenues off the back of that. We were selling the same things, we were just doing it directly. And that really was kind of the beginning of the challenge, which is face the rights market for the agencies. And then once I fell out of that, I decided to go against my own logic and go and join one of the best sports agencies out there at the moment, certainly from a rights perspective, Hitch International, and developed my experience of selling on a more global basis. I was head of Africa, Asia, and North America for Pitch for 2 years. I did kind of wonder what everybody else was doing in the business. I seem to have a pretty big patch, to be fair. But it was... And then after leaving there, I joined Kantaro to come and head up their UK business. And Kantaro were doing some pretty interesting things at the kind of cutting edge of sport. They were the first people to stream an England game, obviously via the internet with the guys over at Perform, who I'm sure will crop up later on. And then having left there, I was headhunted by the UFC to kind of take a bit of a left turn and go and join a real challenger brand and an up and coming business and really a very undeveloped sport in essence, you know, a brand new sport and trying to kind of punch it into mainstream consciousness. And I ended up running the European and Middle Eastern business for those guys for 4 years until the business was sold to IMG. And then kind of the circle had completed itself, and I decided that I kind of didn't want to go back to IMG and wanted to break out on my own, and I'd made enough money for other people and decided to try and do something for myself instead.
Wow. I've got to say, we could be here all day. I'm worried about this. There's so much in there. You know, one thing I have to jump in and ask you, James, because Roger and Giles have extensive backgrounds in the business of sport, and I come to this from the perspective of a fan. You know, I'm a fan of sport, and that's kind of where my questioning always comes from, because I'm just intrigued to get a look behind the curtain. The FA, you spent some time inside the sort of belly of the beast, and as a football fan, the impression that every football fan has of the FA is this stodgy, staid organization that can't get out of its own way, can't innovate, can't change, you know, men in blazers kind of things. Can you give us a sense of what it's actually like inside the FA? Because I'm fascinated.
I think that's a double-edged sword, the answer to that question, because there is a lot of that. There is a lot of institutional dysfunction within the Football Association. That much is clear. However, there are within it some absolutely brilliant people, and there certainly were when I was part of that commercial team, who care passionately about football and about sport. You know, there's a lot of people there who have dedicated their entire lives to sport and their entire lives to football and to grassroots football. So whilst on my very first day at the FA, I had to beat my way through a throng of photographers and someone who tried to handcuff a bed to the outside of the office in Soho Square. So it's kind of, I did wonder what den of iniquity I was joining. But it was, you know, once you got inside, there were a lot of people who are facing an awful lot of pressure from the entire country in relation to how football is perceived. I think the FA get an awful lot of stick for things which aren't their fault. I think they are a useful shield for some of the more rampantly commercial decisions that are made. And, you know, people like it was always markedly obvious to me when the Premier League had bad news, it was the FA Premier League. And when it was good news, it was Premier League. And that was, you know, that's lessened off a little bit now. But, you know, they are kind of a collateral damage in a lot of the things that they actually don't have that much influence over. But, you know, from a commercial proposition, you know, the turnaround in fortunes of the FA over the last 15 years, which really has begun with Adam Crozier's reign, you know, it's been a remarkable success story in the Football Association. I don't think they get enough credit, to be honest.
How do you deal with being a part of an organisation like that is trying to take things forward? And again, as you said, you're coming up against this institution, which is what it is. You know, anything that's 100 or plus years old is an institution. So how do you, as someone in a department that's really trying to push the boundaries and bring this thing up to date, how do you deal with the challenges of perhaps having to try and convince the sort of powers that be that this is the direction we have to go in?
I think it's all about doing things with the right spirit for me. You know, I think there's always a thought process that runs through football fans, and I'm a football fan myself, that people are just rampantly commercial, and that's really not the case. The FA don't do a lot of deals because they're not the right deals for them to do, or they're not the right partners for them to take. But they have bills to pay, and those bills are pretty significant. And I think the work that the FA does on a grassroots basis is very expensive, and takes a lot of money, takes a lot of finding. Now, within that, there are a lot of people who believe that every pound that the FA spends is another child's football boot that could be being bought, and that's a difficult one to get over. You know, you've got some people in the committee system within the Football Association who have dedicated their lives to grassroots sports, and they turn up at Wembley and they see this, what they perceive to be largesse, being handed around, and it rankles with them. And I think that's just a challenge that all governing bodies have in having to play both sides of the table, really. You know, they've got to generate the revenue, and they've got to try and push it forward, but they've also got to be respectful of the past and of the fact that the North Riding FA, not to single them out, but the North Riding FA can't move as quickly as some of the other associations, some of the other teams, and as quickly as they would like them to. So it's, you know, the lots of elements of the grassroots game exist on goodwill and volunteers, and marrying those two commercial things are very tricky, but I think the FA have done a good job. I think the investment into St. George's Park is certainly beginning to reap dividends. You know, the structures of the academy system that were put in place are certainly benefiting the England team and Premier League and Championship teams up and down the, you know, around the country. So again, I think they have a, it's being pulled in two different directions, and I think it's a very delicate balancing act. But in the main, people are receptive as long as it enables the whole thing to move forward and to address the main spirit of the FA, which is to develop and further and grow the game.
James, it's Giles here. As you know, in a former life, I used to buy the odd sponsorship around the world, and in fact never got involved with football, but was certainly offered it pretty much every day for 12 years. I'm interested, particularly as Roger asked his beautifully delicate question right at the top of the show. Are you excited? You've obviously set up a new business. Are you excited about the new commercial model of sponsorship of sport, of the opportunity for rights holders, not just in the big guns like football, but in maybe smaller sports? And if so, why? Where is the value, do you think, that for a big lumbering commodity-based corporation, of which there are many, who are trying to distinguish and differentiate themselves, why, and well, is sponsorship in a good place, and is it an exciting future? And the reason I ask the question is, assuming that you set up a business thinking there's money to be made, why?
I think there definitely is a future, and it definitely is an exciting time. But I think it's an exciting time for organisations that have the ability to respond to it. I think there's one of the key elements for me is that, in the same way that I don't believe that you can just take a check from a broadcaster now and put your feet up and think your work is done for 3 years, it's the same thing with the sponsorship. So all the sponsorships which you see being done now are being done in a different way, and they want different ROI from it. They want different engagement with it. They want a direct relationship with the fans. I think that offers an opportunity for every business to benefit. It's going to be different, and some businesses are going to take a haircut. Some of them have an inflated position within the market. But I think those ones that do reorganize themselves around the modern world and can kind of take advantage of this chaos that we find ourselves in at the moment are going to build themselves a pretty robust business and something which, if they live within their means, and I think that's the crucial point, we'll go on to grow kind of incrementally over the next few years.
Chaos is
a ladder, and I think there are some people who want to climb it and some people who are able to climb it, and if you don't have that much baggage, you stand a better chance.
Do you think, therefore, I'm really interested in what you're saying, because the words that are bandied around a lot in every conference around the world in sport is obviously first view of fan and data, and that's the new model, which I absolutely buy into and I agree. I wonder, and it's just an open question, really, I wonder how many of the rights holders pay a kind of homage to the sentiment, but are actually doing bugger all with the... changing the commercial rights model, really. They're just saying, yes, we know data is important. We know that sponsors want data. But are they really mining the data? And secondly, even if they are, is that business model coming through? Are we seeing sponsors who are now showcasing they are the data champions and changing their business model? Or are we living in the middle of a revolution that is sort of coming through and out the other side?
That's a great question. I think anytime you have data but you don't have any insight, it's a dangerous thing. And I think, you know, the old Vic Reeves gag that 64.8% of statistics are made up rings true in certainly when you're discussing some sponsorship revenues. You know, I think this is the world which we're living in now. You know, and I think I don't believe, to your kind of first point, I don't believe that many organisations are properly mining and properly understanding their audience and properly understanding the data. Lots of people are doing it, but those who are saying they're doing it, but those people who are saying they're doing it probably aren't doing it that well. And I think this is one of the great challenges that we have is that over-reliance on data and then a lack of actually interpretation of that data and an overlaying of experience and of analysis over the top of it to actually deliver it. And you're absolutely right. Most sponsors will find a way to make the numbers from their engagement, their social media, blah, blah, blah. Now find a way to justify it internally. But as we head further down the road and more data points are available for people to analyze, you know, it's going to get harder and harder to actually prove this direct relationship that everybody is championing. It's clearly the way the industry is going, but I'm not sure anybody really understands it yet or really understands how to directly monetize it. You know, you look at some of the work that you can do, and I've done this recently with some properties where we spent an awful lot of money on kind of ad targeting digitally, and it really didn't give us much return. The return we actually received, or when we did start to see some return on it, was when we did traditional PR and we did traditional kind of personality-led marketing. That's what drove it. And actually, the rest of it, you know, we've all been on websites, and I remember going on to look at a pair of trousers once, and these pair of trousers followed me on the internet for 6 months. I know it's not a deliverable ROI. that's just somebody justifying it. As you get more and more targeted, it's going to get harder and harder to kind of define that.
James, I'll come in here because I'm sure Grant there is fuming at his own experiences of digital marketing, and I'll leave that for him later while he calms down a little bit. But
I pick a scab there? Sorry.
Yeah, you did. I've got a couple of questions that are equally as punchy, I think. You're right. There's a lot of buzzwords and a lot of cliches these days, and we're all kind of like fumbling a little bit. I want to ask you about two very pertinent things this week. One comes back to you mentioned the FA and Bet365, and you know the future of betting saving the industry. Then you see immediately what happens when they try. And the second one is the CPMs that Amazon paid for the advertising, and whether the advertisers were satisfied with the level of data that Amazon was promising them. Those are two very pertinent moments in sport that are leaning towards the new model, and I'm not sure either of them have come out of the week in a positive shape.
Firstly, to kind of answer the Amazon piece, I think that's a really interesting one. I mean, I saw something that it was four times the price that Sky would pay, and I think unless you can that depth of data, and I haven't seen any of it yet, nor have I seen what they were promised. But kind of to go back to that. To that point about the trousers following you around, you know, as the advertisers are promised more and more kind of in-depth data around the engagement that they can have with their audience, CMOs and CEOs are going to want to have a more defined ROI off the back of it. You know, back in the day when you would buy a 36 sheet advert and bang it up in London, you had no real idea about the returns that you would have. I remember a friend of mine who worked for Coca-Cola. They ran a marketing campaign across the summer, and they had record sales, and they all patted themselves on the back and said, look, this is what a fantastic campaign we had, and it was all done based on outdoor. And actually all that had happened was it had been a really hot summer and people had bought a lot of Coca-Cola. So I think there's a causality piece to understand about that the Amazon data. You know, if they can't define exactly what they're doing, then they're simply not going to be able to make those numbers stand up. It'll be interesting to see whether those advertisers do get that data eventually once Amazon have had the time to process it. And then in terms of the Bet365 piece, this is one of those kind of front page scandals when the FA get to the front page, yeah. My view, they should have just written it out. You know, this is something which is, you know, the betting industry and live streaming has been around for nearly a decade now, if not longer, since Inform started the whole thing off. You know, I think they should have just stood their ground on this. You know, the money that is generated by the FA stands up an awful lot of businesses and an awful lot of Sport England's output, for a start, comes from money derived from football. I think they should have stood their ground. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I think it's a storm in a teacup that they should have ridden.
One further question on Amazon, James. If we analyse the small per game fee that Amazon have paid for these Premiership rights in that small package over Christmas, do you think that's going to be ultimately shooting the Premiership in the foot by setting a precedent so low compared to what they usually pay?
I think that absolutely potential that it could do. You know, I think that with Amazon, we saw this recently with them buying those 16 games in Germany. You know, the story is better than the detail, and I think when you actually drill into it, you know, effectively they've let another broadcaster, a third party, in, and I understand why they've done it, to try and grow the market, because it's clear that nobody else is launching a significant pay TV operation in the UK anytime soon. They've let somebody in the back door at a significantly lower price point. I mean, the numbers haven't been released, which tells its own story, but it's anywhere between kind of 1.1 and 1.4 million per game is what it works out at. And Sky and BT are a blend that's around, you know, the £9 million mark. That's a big difference. And more, you know, if they open that up to Amazon, to move Amazon to that price point is... I think it's going to be impossible. And if I was Sky or BT, I'd be looking at it and going, well, hang on, why are we paying this much for what we're paying? because simultaneously they've managed to let somebody else come in and undercut the value of the rights that somebody else is paying. And they've also made BT and Sky look like granddad in the corner with his Werther's originals in his pocket. You know, everyone was saying, this is how sports streaming should be. This is how it needs to be in the future. And Sky and BT would love to show that many games, but they're not allowed to from the right segmentation. And I think they've been exposed on that. And I think Sky and BT will be very sensitive about being cast as yesterday's story when they're paying tomorrow's bills. And I think that's something which I think the Premier League will need to manage carefully. But if anybody can, the Premier League can, because it's a juggernaut of a rights business in it. And I think Sky won't be letting it go very likely at all.
James, can I ask you about price arbitrage on this stuff? Because it's interesting to me. A Sky subscription now is incredibly expensive, it has to be said. And I haven't lived in England for a lot of years, and I've been spending a lot of time in the US, where the coverage, I have to say, of the Premier League is spectacular. They have they have probably every game on a Saturday is live across the various NBC platforms. Get three games in a row on NBC Sports. They have the rest of the games either on NBC or on NBC Gold. You can watch them all online. So you have a tremendous amount of choice. The coverage, they have English commentators, which makes a huge difference. To all my American friends out there, I do apologize, but it does make a hell of a difference to an Englishman listening to English commentators. And they're basically taking the Sky feed. Now, you can get a subscription to NBC Gold, a Premier League subscription, for $35 a year, I think it is. And in the age of, say, internet streaming, VPNs, etc., how do you manage that? Is it something you can't manage, and you just, as a rights holder, you realize that people are going to kind of game the system, but you just have to kind of ignore that and focus on your home brand? Or is there some way that they can try and maximize this? Because it seems to me it's kind of a bit of a Trojan horse for them.
Yeah, I think VPNs are a big issue. I put VPNs up there alongside piracy as one of the main threats to the pay TV model. And I believe there's a long shelf life left on the pay TV model as well, and on linear TV.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that, the different price points and different models that are available internationally are an issue for the Premier League, just because the world is so much more connected now, and you can understand and you're far more aware of what the consumer proposition is in other markets than you were 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, certainly 10, 15 years ago. You just didn't realize that this was happening. You know, the fact that outside of the UK, people can watch more games of the Premier League than you can in the UK will strike 99% of people as being ludicrous. I think personally, there are valid reasons for it domestically, but I'm not sure the consumer would agree with you or agree with me. So look, I think you can see that Sky are beginning to do this, and BT are obviously doing it as well through making their channels available as a digital-only thing. I have moved my own subscription to Sky over to Now TV, and it works very well for me. Yeah, but I'm still paying 30 whatever it is, 30 quid a month. It's down from 80 quid a month, which is what I was paying. But I'm paying 30 quid a month, and the experience is fine for me, and it's a price point that I'm comfortable with. So I think you'll gradually start to see more and more of these kind of big pay TV behemoths kind of cannibalizing themselves, or attempting to, rather than letting somebody else cannibalize them.
James, let's come back a little bit to segmenting the types of rights holders. I think we all feel pretty comfortable that the super premium rights will still have a future. And we've talked about how newer sports can build from a blank canvas and probably go with some kind of OTT model, and then a funnel of some kind, either via social or free to air. But you mentioned those ones in the middle, the secondary ones that have got an infrastructure, they've got clubs that have got budgets, they've got wages to pay, that can't switch off the pay TV drip feed and go to OTT overnight. You advise these people. What are you saying to them now about how they need to prepare themselves for the next rights cycle that's going to be quite difficult?
I think they need to get in position with a direct to consumer business, but I would not advise them to switch to that as their sole focus. It has to be a parallel path. I'm a massive believer in building on your own land and owning that consumer relationship, But part of why the reason why you would do that is to pour people into the top of your broadcaster's funnel. Because one of the things which the sports industry has been bad at, or been guilty of, I should say, for the last 15 to 20 years, is to sit back, take the check, and let the broadcasters do all the hard work.
Yeah.
I think the reality of the modern world is that the broadcasters aren't set up to do that any longer, and they can't tell the story, and they won't tell the story of the property themselves. So I think you need to, part of the way to maintain values as best you can is to show that you are tooling yourselves up to be able to help them to grow their own business. I just think there's a lot more groundwork that now needs to be done, and you need to work to build not only your own platform but also your broadcaster's platform. And for 20 years, it's been the other way around, and that's the shift which I think you need to show. Just taking the check just isn't going to work anymore. You know, there's, if nothing else, whatever the truth is, in terms of the numbers, the narrative has now taken hold that rights holders are going to start pushing back on rights valuations, and they've certainly been emboldened on doing that with some of the properties. You look at what's happened to La Liga, look at what's happened to Serie A in the UK. You know, clear examples of things which used to always just take a check and it was an easy deal to do, of actually not having any attributable value once they lost. You know, Sky lost the La Liga, and I bet they haven't lost a single subscriber. And 6-7 years ago, they lost the Champions League, and it didn't dent them. You know, they may have had a slight drop off, but they realized, you know what, we've got 700 million in our bottom line, and we haven't lost a subscriber. Those were very, very dangerous times for the sports rights industry, and I think it's coming home to roost now.
Well, and it's interesting to me, and I'm interested to know your thought here, is that it seems to me that if you're a good rights holder and you're a quality organisation with quality commercial people with a quality product, you've got half a chance of making a lot of money. And for a long time, the sports industry has been served by blazers and well-meaning non-commercial folk with a passion for the sport, inverted commas. And that's where you're going to see the withering and the dying of certain sports if they don't start to hire the very best commercial people who understand that, actually, exactly to your point, that if sports want to grow, it's going to be the responsibility of the sports and the rights themselves to mine the value that they have rather than relying on a third party.
Well, 100%. When I was at the UFC, we realized that we were kind of in this kind of hinterland between, we weren't a startup sport. We were very well established, and we had a very big fan base, and a dedicated and passionate fan base at UFC, and they were MMA fans. And but we also knew that we needed to get through to the mainstream, and we knew that the mainstream broadcasters and newspaper outlets and publishing outlets didn't have the expertise in-house to be able to do that. So we actually did something which we called internally Operation Spoon Feed, which was effectively to write press releases and to write stories and to literally spoon feed organizations with the story so that they could tell our story through their own channels. And they did it. It wasn't advertorial, and it wasn't Pravda, but it was part of us being able to communicate our stories through to people. And part of that, I believe that played a big part in opening up the audience that we built subsequently. And it's interesting what you said earlier in terms of the English commentary on the Premier League in the US. We did the reverse of that, and we put English commentary on the US feed and put English voices on our European shows, and told the story in a way which was more accessible to new people and to new audiences and the casual fan, whilst also not patronizing the hardcore. So, but just softening that presentation style and having it be appropriate for the market in which you're broadcasting was crucial in the UFC kind of gaining that traction that they did at the time, because it just enabled it opened the door to the sport to people and allowed people to consume it, understand it. And once they looked twice at the sport, they became hooked on it. And it really helped fuel our growth.
Well, and it's interesting, and I know this is something Roger is very hot on, but the new model is for sports to talk to the audience where the audience already is at, in a way that that audience already wants to hear, rather than just, you know, hoping that people will turn up and arrive at the sport. I'm interested, therefore, you've had a 20-year career, which now makes you an old man veteran, so I'm sorry about that. Welcome to the club. And Roger's even older. He's really old.
Jesus, I'm the oldest in the call. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's true. I'm interested. What sports are you a bull on? What do you think? I mean, we've seen some of the Olympic sports, the winter sports, really have a go and sort of freshen themselves up. And you think of, you know, snow cross and board cross and all of that. Are there other sports, what we would have called in the old days minority sports, that you're kind of a bull on, that go, these guys have got a real shot at growing substantially quickly, which we've obviously seen with MMA and UFC, etc.?
I think combat sports. I think MMA's got massive headroom. I think boxing has still got massive headroom. I think what you'll see in terms of that kind of smaller snackable content, which is a horrible phrase, but is one that's kind of entered parlance now. I think anyone who can serve content to an audience to grab them in that first kind of 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds, has a shot. I think in terms of newer sport, you know, you look at what there's an organization, I'm not sure if you've seen it, called World Chase Tag. And I think they have such a good business. They just need a couple of things to fall in the right way for them, and they'll really kick on. It needs to be really easily. I think the next wave of sports will be things that you can understand. You know, Dana White, it's an old line from Dana White, the president of UFC, but he used to say about MMA, go to any street square, any city square in the world, and on one corner they're playing football, on another corner they're playing basketball, on the third corner they're playing cricket, and on the fourth corner a fight breaks out. Where does the crowd go? They go to watch the fight, because you can understand it. It's very, very simple what is happening. You don't need a huge amount of institutional knowledge. You know, it's things that you can look at and you can get it. And I think any sport that can find a way to communicate that and to deliver that is stands a good shot. It was interesting, actually, just to finish off on that, it was interesting when I was involved in launching Rugby X, the indoor rugby fives, effectively, the O2 in October. And one of the things which came out of that, which resonated the most with the audience, was instead of doing drop goals to decide a tie, it was decided on 1v1, which was basically British Bulldog with a ball. And it was brilliant. And the crowd loved it, and everybody, because it was just so simple to get your head around. I think any sport where you need to read a 17-page manual is going to struggle in the future. I think it's to grow from nothing. I think it'll be sports which are instantly accessible.
So instantly binary, which is ultimately why tennis, men's and women's singles, works, is you understand what it is. It's basically a fist fight with rackets. So the same idea, right?
Exactly.
Nicely put, Charles. James, I have to ask you about Ari Gold, or the real life Ari Gold, because this is someone you've had interest in. Anyone who watches sport has seen that character. It's one of the great characters of the last decade. I'd love a little insight into the man behind the man, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to spend some time with Ari, and he is a force of nature. You're never quite sure when the phone is going to ring, but you can be damn sure he's going to ring. The one thing you learn quite quickly when you're dealing with Ari Emanuel and with Dana White, in fairness, is that wherever they are in the world, they're on their time, and so is everybody else. And I think that's he never stops. He doesn't like to take no for an answer. He was always very good to me, and always very very respectful, and we had very good conversations, if challenging at times. But he's the business they've got is many and varied, and I think if anyone can make it work and put all those pieces together, it will be Ari and Patrick Whitesell over at WME. But they do have a lot of challenges over there. There's a lot of things. They're sitting on a lot of checks they have to write, and the world is the world's not necessarily bending to his will in quite the way that he probably hoped it would do a few years ago. But he is definitely bombastic, and being in a being in a restaurant with him in LA is a fun experience because they Tinseltown definitely know who he is, and it must be a fun life being Ari Emanuel. I can tell you that.
But tell me, James, a little bit. So you know, you've created this property that he's just bought. You're a key part of that. Correct me if I'm wrong. I guess he tries to convince you to stay and become part, as you say, once again, of your alma mater, IMG. How does that conversation go when you say, no thanks, Ari? Is it like entourage, or does he just walk away calmly?
He asked me what I wanted in terms of making it stay. I think thinking that I was going to ask for more money, which I actually didn't, which is probably a mistake on my part. But there was, I actually just said to him, I said, look, one of the reasons that the UFC has been so successful, and one of the reasons that you paid the amount of money you paid for it, was because we spent an awful lot of time and energy banging the drum and making it seem more important than it actually was and bigger than it actually was. That's not to say any untruths were told, but we just, you know, we were the loudest advocates of that business. And I think there's one of the reasons why I said I wanted to go was that I didn't believe that IMG was set up to be able to continue to deliver that. And they were going to take away some of the tools I needed to be able to do my job effectively. And it was fair to say that we disagreed, but it was all, he didn't fly off the handle. There was no smashing of cutlery, but he was, I think at that moment I became dead to him. he moved on pretty swiftly. So it was a fun lunch. And we parted company on good terms, but he was, I'm not sure I want to cross him in any meaningful way. I think he viewed my departure as someone delivering the wrong salad at lunch, to be honest.
So this means Jeremy Piven is a fantastic actor on that basis, because that's exactly how one would expect him to be.
Yeah, I think he's nailed it, to be honest. I think he's nailed it.
Sorry, Grant. It's interesting because I've seen it on the other side. And so much of what you've said about Ari is true. Is that as you will know, for quite a long time, I was one of IMG's biggest clients, and therefore, when I first met Ari and Patrick, I thought, well, you know, they were going to do that classic agency thing of deep obsequiousness and laughing at anything that I said. And quite the opposite. I found myself absolutely just sort of caught up in this typhoon of energy. And this was in China, which is not necessarily their sweet spot. And at the end of it, we all had a very enjoyable dinner. But I don't think, and the guys will laugh here, I don't think I got more than 8 words in, which is quite rare.
Impossible.
I can. They're certainly not lacking for an opinion. And they're good company, you know. And they have a good company, but they're certainly, I'd foul them under bombastic, definitely.
That's quite funny.
James, last question, then we'll wrap up, because this has been superb. We have lived in the last few months the departure of the main players in the sports industry in the UK for the last decade, and I'm talking about Scudamore and Barney Francis. Both have gone within months of each other. Sky has been bought by Comcast. You need to tell us and the listeners how you read all that and where Comcast are going to take all of this now.
No, I think that's, like I said earlier, I think there's life in linear pay TV yet. You know, the takeover from Comcast has shown that there is still a very robust business over at Sky. I think they will use the kind of market uncertainty and instability at the moment to drive down prices, as you would expect them to. That's their job. And I think having Barney going, Barney was always a great advocate of what appeared on screen. And I think that'll be the interesting shift. If Sky move into their new world, obviously with Comcast coming in, and with Rob Webster taking over, you know, it's Rob's from a different background, so it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. And Scudamore was the master of timing. You know, the last round of Premier League rights negotiations, which I think went better certainly than I thought they were going to. I was a little bit more worried about what the result could be. But Sky were bidding with somebody else's money at the time. Yeah. So it was perfect for Scudamore timing, right? That the takeover was agreed, but hadn't been hadn't been confirmed and hadn't gone through yet. So it's, you know, the business was ultimately, without question, it was going to be more valuable with the Premier League than without the Premier League. So I think that was, had that takeover gone through 10, 12 months earlier, I think the result for the Premier League would have been very, very different. And I think Scudamore is sharp enough, he's proved it over his career, to kind of read the tea leaves on that. And I think the next negotiation for the Premier League is going to be very, very tricky, because I don't believe that any of the other major kind of internet digital platforms are going to come and save sport. They're not going to step into the same shoes. They're going to have their own shoes and their own valuation models, and they know more about the business and the audience and the right and the revenues that can be generated from it than anybody else. You know, historically, the rights industry has operated on a lot of gut instinct, and Peter Hutton talks about this, right? It's now very much data driven from these platforms. They know what this is worth to them. And yeah. I think having an understanding of the model, having an understanding of the platform, is the only way that you can engage with that. And I think it'll be very interesting to see where I think Richard will get some very tasty directorships, and will have a very nice kind of end to his career over the next few years. And it's richly deserved for what he's done for English sport. And I think Barney, likewise, gets a lot of stick, doesn't get enough credit, in my view, for what he does for, or what he did for English sport. It's going to be fascinating to see where he turns up, because, you know, he's definitely an advocate of a 360 degree offering to broadcast to consumers. And I think it'll be fascinating to see how he fits into the new world. But yeah, you know, it's interesting times, and I think there's life in Sky yet. That's my main thought process in all of this, is that, you know, the industry needs to prepare itself to focus and to absorb and to attract and engage with a younger demographic, without question. But it also needs to have a parallel path to look after, you know, those of us of a certain age, shall we say, who still have 20, 30 years left of a rights model that we are comfortable with in terms of as a consumer. You know, it's my dad, for instance, is still going to want to turn on Sky and know that it's going to be on 401, and he's hopefully going to be around for a few years, and it's going to be a while till I can get him to engage on downloading an app and doing all the technological side of things which that business model necessitates. So it's going to be interesting. I think there's a parallel path to be built, and I think those major organizations are going to need to flex some things and adapt, but ultimately I think they've got a robust business for a while yet.
Fantastic, James. That's a great way to end, I think. So listen, thank you so much for giving us so much content, which hopefully we grabbed the audience with in the first 3 seconds, as you suggested to us in the middle of your conversation. And listen, wonderful, truly wonderful. And I'll speak to you very soon. Take care, my friend.
No worries. Thanks ever so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure, and really enjoying listening to the content when you put it out. I'm a subscriber. So there you go. You've got me. You can ignore me now.
Thanks very much, James.
Cheers, guys.
Bye-bye. Well, Giles, that was fantastic. We've lost our partner in crime, Grant, who is, I think, on his way to the Cayman's airport or wherever he has to do his
he's
other
so
job.
He's so flash. He's so flash.
He's a spy. I'm sure he's a fucking spy. I'll tell you. I mean, like, all of a sudden he's not there and he's gone.
I know. He's a mystery. All I know is I have seen him once outside MI6 trying to get in at that building there, but I don't know. I'm not sure what it was. Well, Rog, that's been really good fun. I thought James was world-class, and I think it's, as you and I talk about a lot, it's fascinating to see the new commercial model of sport evolving and really unravelling in front of us, and he seems to be one of the generation of sports marketers who is right on top of it, which I'm very, very heartened by.
Yeah, every time I need to get a kind of like clear thought process on some of this stuff, I always drop James a line. Because not only has he got that thought process, he's not sitting on the fence diplomatically as so many of us do, and you get it straight, as I hope everybody heard on this episode. So very pleased that we got that in the can.
That's very good.
All that remains for us to do is to thank everybody, to thank James Elliott, and to let everybody know, remind them that if they want to follow the podcast or rate it or review it, do the usual things, although nobody ever does, but we always need to say that. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at entertainr, as in the word. And if you want to follow Giles,
it's at GilesMorgan71.
And if you want to follow myself, it's RPMComo,
as in the lake. As in
perfect.
The lake. There you go. Very good. Well, we'll speak to you very soon.
Take care, my friend. Bye. Cheers, Captain.